Let's stay on the markets here, bringing Matt Maley, equity strategist over at Miller Tabak. Matt, always great to have you on the program. Let's just start with the S&P 500, closing above 4,500 on Friday. We think about how strong this year has been for the equity market. What surprises you most, I guess, about the setup we've seen through the summer, where you just have had a long string of things people have been concerned about, the taper, not the least among them, and yet the S&P, through all this rotation, manages to continue making records?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the biggest things, of course, is that we still have this emergency level stimulus coming into the marketplace. And now that the Fed is telling us that they're going to start pulling back on that. But that's been able to offset any kind of new negative news that pops up. And it's going to be harder going forward with as the Fed tapers back. And sounds like they're going to do it, just over 6 months, 8 months at the most. It's going to happen relatively quickly. And that's going to make it tougher going forward for us to have it kind of offset any kind of negative new news that might pop up that always seems to happen. And so, I think last week's reaction to the chairman's comments was showed a little bit of a complacency in the marketplace. And I'm just a little bit concerned that the market, it doesn't necessarily mean the market has to roll over in a major way, even though we are heading into that September-October timeframe. But it does, I think, leave the upside somewhat limited.
Matt, I liked your headline on your note this morning. Don't kid yourselves, less stimulus equals tightening. Do you think the Fed really signaled that they are going to start to tighten policy very soon? And if so, what sectors of the market could be hit first?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how. But yes, to answer your first question, yes, I do believe it's tightening. If you're having less stimulus, that is tightening. I mean, what they're really doing, they know it's tightening, to be perfectly honest with you. That's my feeling, that they know it. But they're just trying to keep a taper. It's part of their strategy to keep us from having a taper tantrum. They're okay with it. They even talked about several Fed members flat out said they were worried about some of the level of the froth in some risk assets. And Kaplan, the Dallas Fed president, saying that he was worried about excess leverage, taking of leverage and excess risk-taking. So they're okay, I think, with their policy slowing things down and even causing the market to take a breather here. They just don't want it to happen all at once, because that does cause problems. Now, as for what happens in the overall marketplace, and the second part of your question is where to look, is I think it will cause interest rates to move higher, long-term interest rates, that is. And we see, I'm looking at that kind of 1.3% level that we got up to last the week before last, and which was also the high from over the summer. You break above that, that's going to, get people nervous. And also, I'm looking at the yield curve, the 2-year, 10-year spread. You get above 115 basis points. That's going to get us to shift back, I think, to that thing where people are going to look for value over growth. I mean, not to drone on here, but I just want to say that, there's no question. From August till August of last year until March, we definitely saw value outperform growth. That's because interest rates were rising. When long-term interest rolled over March, the group took back over, and it kind of reversed that trade. I think we're about to go back in the last 4 months of the year, back to that thing where people are going to like value over growth, and banks, energy stocks, and where some of these big cap tech names are going to face some headwinds.
So on that point, Matt, let's talk a little bit about the inflation setup. As you mentioned, I think you're maybe a little more skeptical of the transitory idea than perhaps some at the Federal Reserve are. And is that value trade, is it really going to be benefiting? I mean, certainly the case for financials, and commodities, you can understand that on an inflationary side. But just as a broader, does the inflation signal to you, I guess, does that say something about the strength of the economy, which thus, all else equal, would generally benefit sort of a value-oriented tilt?
That's a very good point, because we definitely want to distinguish between what you think of traditional value, and 5 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, you didn't necessarily think of energy stocks as value trades. But as they underperform badly, and same thing with the financial stocks, I mean, they rose a little bit, but they still underperform quite badly for several years. They have become value plays. But you're right, it's not all value, because the big concern for me on the inflation side is if this whole thing with the Delta variant dies down and the economy picks up. I know you guys were talking earlier about how strong the consumer is. Well, that strength is going to continue on, and that's going to keep the inflation elevated. I mean, it'll probably come down from its peaks, but it'll still be well above the pre-pandemic levels. So that's an issue. The problem is the other side's also a problem. If we have the COVID variant continues to be a problem, kind of surprises everybody, and then we have you think, well, geez, that'll kill demand. No, that creates stagflation because demand will come down, but the problem is the supply chain will continue to be a much bigger problem for much longer than people thought, and that will keep prices higher as well. We're already seeing how chip prices are moving up. People are talking about how chip prices are the new oil. Well, higher oil prices due to supply issues, not demand issues, caused the stagflation of the 1970s. If the supply chain issues stay with us, we'll have again another situation where we have inflation due to supply issues, and again that causes stagflation. That's not good for a lot of stocks, and you really want to be careful on which of those value plays you move into.
And Matt, just before we let you go, switching gears, just a fun one for you on how you're thinking about crypto. I know we've talked about Bitcoin in the past, and certainly it's something that you're going to be getting questions from on your clients, where it fits in. We've seen a lot of other coins, Solana, Ether, have a great summer. Just how are you thinking about the crypto space against this backdrop of inflation, the fundamental backdrop really that we've been discussing here?
Yeah, it's kind of hard because we don't know for sure. Is this going to be a good inflation play? It's interesting that Mr. Mobius, one of the big emerging markets investors of all time, is saying people should go 10%. Most people kind of say 5%. He's now saying 10% gold because he's actually more worried about currency devaluations. But that's also an inflation play. And will that be something that we also see in Bitcoin? It's hard to know that for sure, but on a technical basis, there's no question in my mind, the fact that they're pulling back a little bit today, I guess one of the guys from the who called the last crisis. He talked about that it's going to be worthless eventually. I don't know, but the point is, on a technical basis, it made an unbelievable nice low at 30,000 level. It broke out above the 40,000 level, broke above its 200-day moving average. Right now, it's just taking a breather. This is normal and healthy. I am a long-term bull. This thing could go anywhere over the short term, but on a technical basis, I think this most recent kind of sideways move of the last couple of days is simply a breather, and the breakout we saw earlier this summer means it's going to go higher before the end of the year.
All right, we'll leave it there. Always fun. Matt Maley, equity strategist at Miller Tabak. Matt, appreciate the time this morning.
But first, let's start on Tropical Storm Ida, which slammed Louisiana and key oil assets on Sunday at Category 4 status. Joining us now is Dan Dicker, the Energy Word founder. Dan, always good to speak with you here. Talk to us a little bit why we're not seeing a bigger reaction in the oil and gas markets here.
Well, first of all, Brian, I think the oil guys have gotten really good about dealing with these storms, especially since Katrina, the big storm that really knocked out supply both in the Gulf of Mexico and also the distribution from the Gulf Coast refineries afterwards. And since then, they've just done a tremendous job. And basically, these storms keep getting more frequent and more ferocious, and yet they get better and better prepared for them. So in the Gulf of Mexico, that 1.75 million barrels that came offline, when the wind goes under 25 knots, they're right back taking the covers off and they'll be back in production in 18 hours. The refineries will be a little bit longer. I mean, those take a little while to ramp up. So I think we're going to see some higher gas prices, particularly in the southern areas of the country. That might last a month or so. There's never a storm that happens where the refinery guys and the pipeline guys don't use it as an opportunity to catch a little break in terms of better rack prices at the pumps.
Well, Dan, let's talk then about sort of what we've seen in the energy market and the gas market. You had the Colonial Pipeline. What was that, 3-4 months ago at this point? That was a catalyst for some higher gas prices. Talking about this as a potential catalyst for higher gas prices. What is the setup today in the oil markets? Crude right around 70. I think, it's now been, 18 months since the negative 40 print. I mean, where is the market going from here? Have we found stabilization, let's say, in that 60 to 70 range? Or do you think, it's likely higher for oil prices and then in turn gas prices?
I mean, you know, this storm is very much a bump in the road. The two big things we're looking at are very obvious. First, of course, the pandemic Delta and how bad that's going to get in terms of shutdowns and then, you know, growth problems and the same kinds of things we saw, you know, 8 months ago with the original virus. So we're always watching that. We're watching the rates of infection and the death numbers and how that's going to play out in those anti-vaccination states, for lack of a better word. The second thing, of course, is OPEC themselves, who has taken the opportunity of higher oil prices to put together, you know, an increase in production. That's managed to scuttle prices a bit. I mean, we had a drop of close to $12. It's rallied back about $5. A lot of that has been part of a technical bounce as well as this storm. It has made a difference in terms of oil prices going back to around 66 and change and so on. But, you know, right now what we're going to look at, particularly with this OPEC meeting coming up on Wednesday, is whether they will stick to that increase in production. Generally, you get the OPEC guys tend to turn chicken when they see oil prices go up and up, which they feel they can get greedy and start to increase production again. Oil prices tend to settle down, and then you wonder whether they're going to get frightened by that settling and renege on the increases in production that they've just recently put into place. My guess is that they won't. They'll have this increase in production, and we're going to resume this kind of flattening of the curve and flattening of oil prices that we started to see towards the beginning of July, actually, and has been running through a large part of August. And I think we're going to see prices again moderate back towards that $60 area until we get further clarity, one, on what OPEC is going to ultimately do, and, of course, in the way that, you know, this pandemic is going to play out in terms of how it's going to affect the global economy. And, I don't see it being a very good trajectory right now.
Dan, someone just handed me a good note out of Goldman Sachs moments ago on the oil market. They're noting, just going back to the storm, they're noting that Valero and ExxonMobil could eventually see a delayed impact to their operations as, I guess, damage is assessed here. Would you agree with that, that these downstream companies are most exposed? And do you think there's an earnings risk here because of the storm to those companies?
You know, this is one of those trader plays as opposed to fundamental plays. So Goldman is right. The downstream is going to have an issue in this quarter from the storm. They always do. It's small. It's something that can be moderated and so on. But the trade has always been to buy these refiners right before the storms sort of gin up in the Gulf. And for Valero, particularly because it is the premier Gulf Coast refiner, it's had a 12% move up, you know, over the last four or five sessions. So the question is whether the fundamentals start to impact what now that the storm is dissipating and going north. And my guess is that, yes, you've seen a very, very nice run in Valero, which got under 60 bucks and is now, you know, in the mid 60s, 66 and a half or so. And it would be a time if you had that trade, which, by the way, some of my subscribers did. I gave it to them as an old school kind of storm refinery trade, that this would be a great moment to cash in on some short term profits in those refinery stocks.
Dan Dicker, the Energy Word founder. Always good to see you. Stay safe, sir.
Ah, thanks, Brian. Thanks. Nice to see you, too.
Many in the buy now, pay later space are seeing a stock price boost following a firm's new deal with Amazon. One of those names is Marqeta, with shares up about 7% so far in today's session. Unlike others, though, Marqeta actually does business with the firm. Joining us now for more is Marqeta founder and CEO Jason Gardner. Jason, good to see you this morning here. So as I mentioned, you in fact do business with the firm. What do you do with them, and how does this Amazon deal that they struck, how does this impact you?
Well, we're very happy to power a firm in their buy now, pay later solution. So what we do is we help companies like Amazon, Klarna, Zip, Afterpay, basically connect to the point of sale. So think of us as like the last mile. We call it a server-to-server virtual card. So when you're a consumer and you want to buy now, pay later with a firm or others, it generates a 16-digit card. And that card could be Visa or MasterCard. It's then inserted into the checkout flow, which makes it very easy for the buy now, pay later companies to set up with merchants. and really allow them to sign up and move pretty quickly in regards to options for consumers.
And Jason, I was talking to some folks this morning on just how much of a financial impact this will have on a firm, but by extension, it has to have a financial impact on your business as well, no?
Well, we're very proud to power a firm, helping them. They're penetrating the largest e-commerce company in the world. We power a number of solutions for a firm, Klarna, Afterpay, Zip, as we talked about. And we don't go specifically into how we power them which merchants we power them with, but we're excited to have them as a customer.
So Jason, you talk about being this last mile connection of a sort between online transactions. I'm curious, and I think this is a question that people generally have about this new payment method, whether it is BNPL, whether it's just an in-house credit solution for a certain merchant, so on and so forth. Are you guys taking on any of the credit risk in that, or are you helping to just facilitate the transaction between the two parties? How do you fit into that?
Yeah, so we don't take on any credit risk. We're really just facilitating the two parties working together. And buy now, pay later is 40% of Americans used this method last year. If you look at Europe, it was a European phenomenon. Companies like Klarna invented this and then came to the United States. Think of it as like reverse layaway. So the way layaway had worked is, the good, what you're looking to buy sits at the merchant. And then when you pay it off, you receive it. Now we've reversed that with buy now, pay later. We're getting the product or the good in advance, and then you're paying it off over time. Now, consumers have to pay their bills. That credit is provided by a firm. And again, we're just facilitating the two parties and making sure that they can, streamline the checkout method.
Now, Jason, you guys, you had your results about 3 weeks ago. You came public via an IPO this year. I'm just curious, what that process was like with this environment. We're talking about, companies, different industry, but a company earlier today announcing a fundraise of valuation 3x what it was 6 months ago. There's a lot of appetite for new businesses, and certainly you've had interactions with the street over the last several months. What has that process been like for you guys trying to balance both the fundamental growth of your business, but certainly the investor enthusiasm for companies in your space and new companies generally?
Yeah, so when we started the company back in 2010, I mean, fintech or financial technologies wasn't even a thing. I mean, nobody was really talking about it. And companies like Marqeta that built an open platform for companies to build payment cards, whether Visa or MasterCard cards. And we found that our technology allowed companies to disrupt entire industries or solve enormous problems at scale. So companies like Instacart, when their shopper goes into the store, they swipe that card to pick up your groceries. We get the message from the point of sale. We deliver that to Instacart. And Instacart basically goes through that message. Is the shopper on shift or in the right merchant at the right time? Is it the right amount based on the basket size? And then they tell us to authorize the transaction on their behalf. So we do that millions of times a day. We allow these companies to scale pretty significantly. This technology called issuing and processing is very deceptively complex. And we see this within the financial technology space. We decided 18 months ago we wanted to become a public company. This was very much a personal decision for me as the founder and CEO. And then, really 6 months before you go public, you get really deep into the process. And it was a great journey. We're really happy to be a public company. We felt like this was the next step in our journey. And now we're finding, wow, the amount of venture capital that is really flowing into these companies at massive valuations, I think it shows that we're in the very early innings in regards to the opportunity, not only within the space, but really the world is going, which is, all this volume is living on legacy platforms and moving to modern platforms like Marqeta.
And Jason, a lot of focus continues to be on Square with that $29 billion purchase of Afterpay. Square, from the numbers that I have seen, accounts for about 72 or 73% of your business. Does it make more sense for your company to be under that Square umbrella?
Well, Square is 73% of our business, as we said in the S-1. And what we've seen is they've adopted many different areas of our platform, both on the consumer side with Cash Card. We also power all of the ACH there. We also power the card on the Square Card side. We just recently announced that Square is using our checking solution on the merchant side. And we see, like, their success is our success. We're seeing them adopt many different areas of our platform. You talked about the acquisition of Afterpay, or the upcoming acquisition of Afterpay hasn't closed yet. But Afterpay is not a top five customer of Marqeta. They use a different part of the platform. But this shows the power of modern card issuing. This shows the ability for Marqeta to service many different facets of our customers. And we want Square to continue to grow and service them, obviously, into the future.
Fascinating time to be in this space. Marqeta founder and CEO Jason Garner, looking forward to staying in touch.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate the time.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. Oh, with just one day to go until the U.S. completes its withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Biden administration is warning of potentially more attacks ahead. The U.S. just today intercepted more rocket fire at Kabul airport, just as the military is continuing its evacuation efforts out of the country. For more on the path ahead, let's bring in Georgia Congressman Buddy Carter joining us today. And Congressman, it's great to have you on. When you think about the evacuation efforts that have been underway, this is an incredible undertaking, well over 110,000 American citizens, as well as Afghans being airlifted out of the country. What's your very latest assessment of whether, in fact, this can all be completed by the U.S. self-imposed deadline tomorrow?
Well, first of all, we're hearing varying numbers. I mean, this morning we're hearing the administration say there are only 250 Americans left in Afghanistan who want to come out. But those numbers don't match up with what we've been hearing in some of our secure briefings. So I'm a little hesitant to accept that as factual. But nevertheless, the point is that tomorrow is the cutoff day. Tomorrow is the day that the Biden administration had allowed for us to get out of there, and that the Taliban is now holding us to that. And I think it's a grave error in judgment to do that. We should not leave one American in Afghanistan, not one. We should make sure everyone is out of that country who wants to get out of that country. We don't leave anyone behind in America. And it's just a shame that this has happened. And what's so bad about it is it should not have happened. This is, you know, this is all just a disaster, and an unmitigated disaster that should not have happened and that could have been avoided. I mean, the administration has handled this in such a way that it's the worst foreign relations debacle in the history of our nation. And it's just inexcusable. Wait.
Congressman, when you say it could have been avoided, what specifically would you have done differently?
Well, first of all, the Biden administration and Joe Biden has tried to blame this on the agreement that the Trump administration had with the Taliban to begin with. Well, a couple of things there. First of all, they've gone against every other agreement that the Trump administration has had. So it's not as if they had to follow this. They could have changed it. But the Trump agreement was a conditions-based agreement. We've heard that firsthand from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who's made it perfectly clear that that agreement said that Taliban, if you do this, we'll do this. If you do this, we'll do this. But that was not the case. The Biden administration and Joe Biden went the opposite and made the decision to just get out of there, and then get out of there completely. And what did they leave behind? They left behind and stranded American citizens. They left behind Afghanistan interpreters who need to get out of there and should be able to get out of there. There are allies, and that's just inhumane to treat them this way. And, oh, by the way, they left behind a cache of weapons, over 600,000 weapons, over 87,000 vehicles, 200 aircraft. All of those things they left, and they're our weapons, and now they belong to the Taliban. And even worse, some of them are probably going to fall in the hands of some of these other terrorist organizations and be used against us.
Yeah, Congressman, I mean, it's been shocking how quickly, you know, a lot of this has played out. And obviously, the timeline, I think, comparing back then versus now, you know, it happened so quickly. But you're right to point out some people saying millions to billions of dollars worth of military equipment there. I mean, a lot of it seems to have just stemmed from the fact that the hope was the government they were hoping to establish there, the Afghan government, would have been able to inherit those weapons and U.S. allies. And now, I mean, with that being the case, what in your mind do you think was the biggest shock in terms of maybe misestimating the timeline that the Taliban was going to come in here and how poorly constructed the you know, the Afghan government that the U.S. was trying to set up basically fell apart?
Well, I think that everyone, Democrats and Republicans together, would agree that Joe Biden handled this in the worst sort of way, and that the Biden administration was totally at fault in this. And however, I am disappointed in some of the Department of Defense and General Milley and General Austin, that they weren't more vocal and that they didn't see this coming. And our intelligence had to have been warning them. And I wasn't there, and I don't know what the IC said, but I can imagine that they did warn that this could potentially happen. And why didn't they listen to that? And why didn't they prepare for it? There was no preparation here. There was no forethought, no plan, no strategy whatsoever. And that's what's so disappointing here. And that's what's so outrageous and that we can't accept. We should not leave that country. And August the 31st means nothing to me. We should not leave that country until we have every American out of there. Every American who wants to come out, we need to make sure, because we are Americans, we do not leave anyone behind.
So what does that presence look like? If you don't believe that the withdrawal should be completed on August 31st, when you consider how many American citizens, as far as you're aware, as well as Afghan interpreters are left behind, what is that true presence, or what should that true presence look like in Afghanistan?
Whatever it needs to look like. And I mean, if it takes the full force of our army to get those people out of there, that's what we should be doing. We should make sure that every American is out of there. We should make sure that the Taliban, that ISIS, whoever it might be, understands that we are America and we do not leave anyone behind. No American should be left behind. That's all there is to it. And any date that is set means nothing. We will always make sure that we get every American out of there. And that's what's so vitally important.
Yeah, that's a tricky piece of all this, too, is, you know, you have more troops in there and then you got to worry about getting those troops out, too. It's almost as if President Biden has just interpreted that it was going to end at some point and needed to end now. I know you've talked about specifically when it comes to treating the troops on the vaccine front, maybe some hesitation about vaccine mandates when it comes to the COVID vaccines there. They've since been approved by the FDA. I'm curious if that maybe changes your position at all when you think about how this country is looking at vaccination among service members.
Well, first of all, I don't agree with mandates at all. Now, having said that, I will tell you, I am a strong advocate for the vaccine. I went through the clinical trials myself. In fact, I've had the booster shot myself, and I believe in the vaccine. It's safe. It's effective. Vaccines are the single most life-saving innovation in the history of our country, in the history of medicine. They've saved more lives than any drug has saved. And I would encourage everyone, because it is safe and it is effective. I'm proof of that. I went through the clinical trials, as I say. So I would encourage everyone to get that. Talk to your doctor, talk to your pharmacist, talk to your family about it, and make that decision. This is a decision that should be between you and your doctor, you and your pharmacist, you and your family, not between you and the government. No, I do not believe in mandates. However, I do encourage everyone to get the vaccine because it is safe, it is effective, and it is, listen, I'd much rather have the vaccine than to have the virus. So again, I'm a strong advocate for the vaccine, but I'm just not one who believes in mandates. I do not think that's the route we should be going.
And Congressman, switching to what we're seeing here on the domestic front, obviously the infrastructure bill still needs to pass the House. We've heard the Democrats in the House say they want this on two tracks specifically. How are you viewing the timeline of this, specifically the ability to pass it by the end of September?
Well, first of all, these two should not be related whatsoever. I mean, you've got a $1.1 trillion infrastructure spending bill that was passed by the Senate in a bipartisan fashion. 19 Republican senators voted on that. And it encompasses what most of us would consider to be infrastructure. That is roads, bridges, airports, seaports, broadband, high-speed internet. Okay, that's what I think most Americans think of when we talk about infrastructure. But no, the speaker, she wants to tie that in with a $3.5 trillion, which is really, it figures out to be $5.5 trillion. She wants to tie that in and say you can't have one without having the other. And what is in that $3.5 trillion mammoth budget reconciliation that she wants to get through? It's just a socialist wish list. It's progressive priorities. Included in that is not only $68 trillion in spending over the next 10 years, but also $17 trillion that will be added to our deficit over the next 10 years. And that's bad enough to think that we're going to do something like that, that will be nothing more than and nothing less than an intergenerational theft to the children and grandchildren who are going to have to pay for that. But also the policies that are included in that, free childcare, free college, free everything, amnesty for illegal immigrants, doubling the size of the IRS. All of those things are extremely dangerous to our country as well. They're socialist wish list items that should not be included in this, and this should not be tied together. We should take this $1.1 trillion spending bill and consider it on its own merits, not tied into this $3.5 trillion progressive priority list.
And Congressman, if we can end the conversation back on Afghanistan, you know, we were talking about just how many people are being evacuated by the U.S. military, specifically Afghan interpreters. The number can still be debated, but no matter how you slice it, there is a significant amount of Afghans, number of Afghans who are coming to the U.S. You've got some of your Republican colleagues who've talked about a potential vetting system that needs to be set up in place. I wonder how you're looking about accepting those interpreters who have helped American, not just troops, but journalists as well. How many of those will Georgia be opening their doors to? Talk to me about how you're looking about Georgia's involvement in all of that.
Well, the governor has indicated that we would be receptive to possibly taking in some of these Afghanistan interpreters who helped us while we were over there. And certainly we've been working diligently in our office, and I know other congressional offices, to try to safely get some of these people out of there. Now, it's going to have to be a strong vetting process. And none of us are naive enough to believe that some aren't going to try to sneak in, that some who are with intent on hurting us aren't going to try to go through that system. So that's why we've got to make sure we have a strong vetting system. And that'll be the key in how many we accept and how many are allowed into this state or into this country, regardless. And that, again, brings up the issue of our southern border, our poor southern border, where we know that terrorists are coming across that border now. We know that 1.1 million illegal immigrants have come across that border since the first of the year. And we know that these people are going to be trying to come across that border as well.
Republican Congressman Buddy Carter from Georgia, it's great to talk to you. Really appreciate the time today.
Thank you.
The U.S. is now averaging over 100,000 COVID-19 hospitalizations a day for the first time since February, while deaths have climbed to 1,000 a day for the first time since March. Joining me now is Dr. Manish Garg, emergency medicine physician and co-founder of World Academic Council of Emergency Medicine. Dr. Garg, it's good to see you again. Tell us what you're experiencing. What are you seeing in terms of hospitalizations, and are most of those being hospitalized unvaccinated?
Great. Thank you, Alexis. It's wonderful to see you again as well. And just to begin, I wanted to say that I have no conflicts of interest with industry, and my thoughts are my own. So yes, Alexis, I would say that these numbers are not good. It's really a reflection of how contagious the Delta variant is and how vulnerable vaccinated and the unvaccinated patients are getting infected in this country. So right now, in the last week, when we reviewed our data from within our own hospitals in New York, almost the entire majority of hospitalized in the intensive care unit patients were unvaccinated. So we are seeing cases of patients who've had previously vaccination, and then they have a level of sickness, They're not in the severe category of death or intubation or ICU stay. It's those who are unvaccinated. And when we start looking at the numbers nationally, there's some data coming out that one in five American ICUs has reached or exceeded 95% of the full beds. That's just terrible because they're running out of beds, staff, and equipment. And for those of us who were on the front line in New York City in March and April of last year, it's very triggering. I mean, we think about all that time that we spent there, and our heart just goes out to all of our colleagues and healthcare workers around the country. And if you take this information from multiple COVID trackers, like you've mentioned, the cases going up, the hospitalizations going up. Unfortunately, since it is a majority of folks being unvaccinated that are in the hospitals, we should anticipate in the next couple of weeks to see more deaths.
And certainly Florida is one of those states where ICU beds are in demand, and they are leading the country right now in COVID hospitalizations, doctor. You know, since the early days of this pandemic, parents have been taking some comfort from the fact that the virus is much less likely to cause serious illness in children than it is in adults. Has that narrative now changed with the Delta variant?
This is a great question. And Alexis, I know we've talked about this before previously. I think schools starting up right now, obviously many parents are very concerned about their kids going into school right now. I think what's really important for people to realize about the Delta variant is that the Delta variant, if with vaccination, the Delta variant has been stopped in terms of this very, very worst possible outcomes, which is death and intubations. It's understandable that right now with vaccinations, we're having people have initial symptoms. And so for those of us in the public health sector, we actually feel that the vaccines are working. This concept of breakthrough infections is something that probably is portraying it in a poor light. It almost makes it seem like the vaccination has a poor veil. We know that 97% of people are hospitalized, are unvaccinated. And we still don't know the number of folks who are symptomatic. That's probably in a range of 50 to 70%. So for those of us that have been vaccinated, you need to know that there's a misunderstanding that's general around the world that essentially if you've been vaccinated, you have memory B and memory and T cells that are there that can either create new antibodies or fight off the infection. So having been vaccinated is good for the majority of folks. It's those who are immunosuppressed or immunocompromised that will need the booster. It's those who are older and have comorbidities that will likely need the booster. But right now, Alexis, we're worried about the kids. So we're still waiting to see when the shoe will drop for when kids can get vaccinated. Right now, it looks like they're talking about in the next couple months that they'll have the data, then they'll be able to send it. And we're hoping that somewhere in November through January, they'll be able to actually put it out. Unfortunately, when looking at early polls and surveys, there's only about a 25% positive likelihood that parents are going to vaccinate their kids. So we need to do a much better job in terms of messaging families so that people can be empowered to protect their health.
Absolutely. And I know that speaking of those breakthrough cases, those who are vaccinated coming down with COVID-19, there is now this variant that was first detected in South Africa that is said to be even more infectious than other mutations. What do you know about that and how effective the current vaccines on the market are to protecting us against it?
Well, you're talking about the new C1.2 variant that's been found in South Africa right. In May. It's been found in the regions of Johannesburg and Pretoria. It is very concerning, Alexis, in that it shares certain traits with other variants of concern. So it has increased transmissibility and an increased ability to evade bodies. I was trying to take a look before our conversation about the different regions right now. They've identified 8 countries in different regions of the world, Africa, Oceania, Asia, and Europe. In fact, those countries right now that have reported cases include South Africa and the Congo, New Zealand, Mauritius, China, England, Portugal, and Switzerland. And in my discussion with my colleagues around the world as part of the World Academic Council, we're still learning more. We don't know exactly how well our vaccines should work. They still should work very effectively against this particular variant, as it has against other variants like Lambda and Delta. But right now, the CDC and the WHO haven't labeled it as a variant of interest or a variant of concern. But all of this is further evidence that we really need to make sure that we can get vaccines out globally. Right now, you see that there's a travel ban that Europe is having with the United States. That's probably in reciprocity to the fact that U.S. has banned European travelers for the last 536 days. So, I mean, again, this is essentially further evidence that we need to do a better job internationally. And I'm a little bit worried that this travel ban might cause some tense relationships between the countries that are vaccine plentiful versus those that are vaccine in need. And we need all of our countries around the globe working together so we can help in this pandemic.
But Doctor, having said that, do you think that it is the prudent thing to do right now for the U.S. and Europe to say, you know what, no non-essential travel right now until we get our arms around these variants?
I mean, the numbers are about the same when you look at the number of case counts and the number of deaths. I mean, from a public health standpoint, it makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, for me, with that particular hat on, I completely understand and agree with it. But from just kind of understanding how the global economy works and understanding how relationships work and just the way the back and forth nature of the global community works, I think it would actually work to kind of make more tension than probably than we would like to have.
Mm-hmm. All right. Dr. Manish Garg of the World Academic Council of Emergency Medicine, thanks as always for being with us.
Aftermath of Hurricane Ida, the storm shutting down and causing significant damage to a number of businesses in the state of Louisiana. So we want to talk to one of the business owners that was directly impacted by the storm. And not only that, but what they're feeling from COVID and also just the supply constraints that they are facing. For that, we want to bring in AJ Kumaran. He's a co-CEO and co-COO of Raising Cane's Chicken Fingers, based in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And AJ, it's great to have you on. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know you guys are extremely busy over the last 24 hours or so, but just give us an assessment just on what you're seeing on the ground there and how many of your restaurants have been impacted, because as I understand it, you have just over 60 restaurants in the state of Louisiana.
Yes, ma'am. Thanks for having us. So as you know, Todd is in Louisiana. He's actually in Baton Rouge, hunkered down, kind of helping our teams gather together and make progress on the storm. It's a crazy storm, you know. It's thankfully, it moved a little bit further east, which kind of spared our Baton Rouge office and the surrounding areas, which is where we're based out of in terms of managing that regional office, et cetera. That said, man, New Orleans is a wreck. Over a million people don't have power, sewage issues, lots of, I don't know when it's going to get better there. All of our restaurants there are shut down. We have a little more than 80 restaurants in the state of Louisiana. And we have 40 of them, a little more than 40 of them, completely shut down. We just opened 3 of them in Baton Rouge about an hour ago. We've got 7 more coming up towards other parts of Louisiana. But like Houma, Thibodeau, all of them has been shut down, and they have no power. It is pretty devastating stuff. It's a pretty serious storm that went through.
Hey, Jay, it's Brian here. Obviously, we hope that you, your team, and all the employees are safe during this scary time. But I guess when it comes to you operating down south, this is not the first time you've seen a storm like this. How do you do contingency planning when it comes to making sure that you do have your employees and everyone safe and that you're deciding which stores are open, which stores are closed? I imagine there's a lot of knowledge sharing with other businesses down there as well.
That's right, Brian. So yes, we have been through Katrina, Harvey, Gustav, all of them. So, you know, I want to say this is not our first rodeo. That said, you know, we started planning as soon as we found out about it. Crew member, customer safety is our number one priority. So we focus on that. Then we send contingency planning, you know. We're not only doing this for business reasons, but it's also like some semblance of normalcy for customers who can come in, have a hot, fresh meal. We try to keep our dining rooms open, et cetera. But I'll tell you, Brian, it's hard, you know? This is the first time we're dealing with something of this magnitude in the middle of a pandemic. So pandemic adds an extra layer of complexity to it. We have over 5,000 crew members that are quarantined due to the pandemic. So it's tough to get all the crew members going. We have to keep them safe, they're masked. Also, by the way, the communication has been pretty hard this time around. Cell phone towers, multiple of them are down. So some of the networks are completely down. So we cannot reach all our people, but we're doing all we can. So there's a group of people in Baton Rouge working from one restaurant, kind of using that as our command center, driving the rest of the Louisiana business. So when it comes to opening, though, we try to open as quickly and safely as we can so that we can be there for our customers and also for our crew members to earn a paycheck, you know? So that's what we try to do.
And AJ, speaking of reopening restaurants and opening new locations, I was going through some of your notes here. You're aggressively expanding. You hope to have 600 locations by this fall. Right now, you just have over 560, adding 10,000 new jobs. How are you doing that in this type of environment? You just laid out some of the challenges that your company is facing right now. So how are you attaining some of those goals?
Unprecedented times, right? So, you know, it's very tough staffing market. We created over 10,000 jobs this year. As you mentioned, we are opening about 85 restaurants this year, about 35 to 40 more to come for the balance of this year. We will have a little more than 600 restaurants by the fall of this year. And we just celebrated our 25th anniversary a couple of days ago. You know, Shauna, the most important thing is our culture is rooted in appreciation from day one when Todd opened the first restaurant at the mothership. So that culture truly helps. So even in these challenging times, crew members are not only looking for a financial proposition, they're looking for a place where they're cared for, loved, respected, and also they can grow their careers. So thankfully, we can offer all of that. With the growth that we have, a lot of our crew members grow into managers, go into different jobs in the restaurant support office, et cetera, et cetera. And we have tons of those success stories. And we also believe in sharing in our success with them. For example, this year, the business has been really good, and we were able to share almost $18 million in thank you bonuses to our crew members, and they see that. They see that we share in our success. We also announced our millionaire program with our restaurant partners in the beginning of this pandemic, so that's attracting great talent. So it is tough out there, but I will say we're doing better than most others, and we're very thankful for that, you know?
Now, we've heard anecdotes about the difficulty in keeping your prices low, especially for a brand of your type. How do you manage price pressures right now, not just on the labor side? You talked about the efforts to try to retain talent, but also on the material side, because we know that there's been chicken price inflation over the course of 2021 as well.
It has been very hard, Brian. Honestly, over the course of last 3 months, our chicken prices have gone up almost by 70%. It is going to be a major financial impact this year. And look, we cannot just pass it along to the customer right away, like our suppliers do often to kind of cover their costs. So, you know, it's a financial impact to our business. It has a serious impact. And in fact, just looking over financials for the balance of this year, well over $50 million that we will have extra cost in chicken that is coming through our back doors. That said, we're fortunate that we have supply. We're also fortunate that we have great relationship with our suppliers who are supplying our restaurants. Many restaurants even struggle with that. This is, like I was mentioning earlier, unprecedented times. Supply shortage, pandemic, now a hurricane blowing through, and staffing is a huge concern. So it is something that we've never seen.
Yeah, AJ, talking about something you haven't seen before, I'm sure that running a business over the last 12 or 18 months has certainly been something that business school doesn't prepare you for, life almost doesn't really prepare you for something like this. But what has been the biggest challenge or the biggest, I guess, obstacle that you have had to face as a leader in your company and trying to navigate so many uncertainties at one time?
You're right. This is not taught in any business school. This is the best MBA one could go through. Look, none of us are prepared for it. You know, I don't want to use the word shooting from the hip, but the right word is being very, very nimble. I will tell you the biggest thing I've been surprised by, or sort of has been a learning for me, is how quickly, you know, everyone can, you know, get the matter and move ahead with the program if you communicate really well. If you keep the right intention in mind, and if you keep everybody aligned to the same direction, how quickly that turns into action has been pretty inspiring for us to watch. You know, we were rated number one in safety precautions for all across the entire restaurant industry last year in a survey. And that's not something we went after and chased after. It's all because of the communication protocols we manage. And it was all about remote management. We couldn't even go into restaurants, but crew members followed it. Crew members followed to the T. We use some advanced platforms like camera tracking so that we can quarantine crew members to keep them safe and healthy. All of that is paying off and adding up. I'll surely take that learning into the future on making sure communication is number one, clear communication is ultimate priority, and it does wonders for the business. Not that it's new science, not that it's new magic, but it is a reinforcement of what you always talk about.